Sir, one more note? You sure there's not one more note? All right. Alistair McGrath can remember his first microscope with great fondness. It was given to him by his great uncle when he was about 10 years old. And in fact, one of the reasons it's so easy for him to remember it is that he kept it all these years. And decades later, it still sits on Alistair's study desk. It serves, he says, as a reminder of the power of nature to enthrall, intrigue, and provoke questions. As a teenager with a growing interest in science, Alistair somehow got the impression from certain books that he was reading that the idea of God was an outmoded relic of the past, and that to join the company of the truly scientifically informed, he would clearly have to consider himself an atheist. He did wonder about the meaning and the purpose of life, and he found the suggestion that there was none to be rather bleak, but he was willing to adopt the attitude demanded of him if it was the price of being part of the scientific endeavor. And so as he advanced through his education, he began to prepare himself to go to Oxford University for what he called a serious study of chemistry. And it was at that time that Alistair began to read more widely in the history and the philosophy of science. He was surprised to find in those books a lot of rational thinking about the scope and the reliability and the limits of science, as well as a lot of excellent questions, questions that he himself had been asking. He was coming to a turning point. I had always assumed that when science could not answer a question, there was no answer to be had, is how he explains it. But now he was beginning to realize that there might be other valid sources of input for the questions that most concerned him. I realized I had a lot of rethinking to do, he confesses. Francis Collins, who is the director of the National Institute of Health and was previously the director of the Human Genome Project, can describe his upbringing as pretty much just devoid, not pro or con on religion at all, but just he never really was introduced to it. And so he naturally fell into atheism as he went through his schooling. He got a PhD in physics and then went on to medical school. And it was as he began to practice medicine that he found himself sitting from time to time with patients who had received pretty devastating diagnoses, and he would be listening as they would process the information that they were receiving about their health. And he noticed that when he would sit with people of strong faith, it was really remarkable to him the perspective that they were able to put their situation in, the resilience they had, the glimmers of hope, just everything about how they thought seemed striking to him. And one day he was sitting with a patient who was talking at length about the meaning of what she was going through and her faith perspective. And she turned to him and said, "You know, doctor, you haven't said anything at all. What do you believe?" And that question, says Francis Collins, totally changed his life. What do you believe? He realized he didn't really know. He'd never actually given it a lot of serious consideration. So he began to read. C.S. Lewis was extremely influential to him. And he did come to affirm Christianity and continues to do so publicly and without embarrassment to this day. I'm sharing those two stories because they're actually not uncommon among scientists. At least one of the scientists in our own congregation, in fact, has walked a very similar path. Stephen was brought up in the church, but nevertheless, he reached a point where he felt atheism was the only intellectually honest option. And so for 8 years in his young adulthood, he stayed away from church involvement. But then he came to a point where he began to realize, as he puts it, that science cannot tell you how to live. He, in his turn, realized that he had some rethinking to do. he also began to read more widely, and he decided to return to church, where based on his earlier life experience, he hoped that he would find an encouraging sense of community as well as some resources to help choose and construct a meaningful and a worthwhile life. Science cannot tell you how to live. I find that to be a pretty profound and significant insight. And here's an example of what I think it means. This past fall, the journal Nature published a compilation of research on worldwide food supply and agricultural practices. The following data is some of what was assembled. Of all the land on Earth, 38% is dedicated to agriculture, and that represents the largest use of land compared to other possible uses. It also represents most of the land that's best suited for farming. To create this farmland, worldwide agriculture has already cleared or converted 70% of the grassland, 50% of the savanna, 45% of the temperate deciduous forest, and 27% of the tropical rainforest. And what you find is left beyond that is, of course, deserts, mountains, tundra, cities, ecological reserves, and other lands unsuitable or no longer usable for agriculture. Of all the land that's currently designated for cropland, 62% is designated to growing food that humans will eat. 35% of the farmland is allocated to growing food that animals will eat, which is actually an indirect and often less efficient form of human food production. And then bioenergy and other industrial uses account for the remaining 3% of agricultural land use. Between continents or regions, those patterns vary, but worldwide, overall, those are the percentages. Clearly, a lot of human effort and ingenuity goes into food production. And yet, this same scientific study points out 1 billion people on the planet are chronically malnourished. 1 billion. That's 1 in 7. Now, the researchers can, and they have, provided a lot of data based on numerous studies indicating how strategies of halting agricultural expansion, closing yield gaps on underperforming land, increasing cropland efficiency, shifting diets, and reducing waste could double food production, while at the same time greatly reducing the environmental impact of agriculture. But what these studies do not do and can't do is tell us why we should care. If we want to work toward ensuring every human being on Earth has food to eat and that the world we live in isn't destroyed in the process of making the effort, science has increasingly good information about what strategies are likely to yield what results. The way to get where we want to go would be to make constructive use of all that information that scientific research can provide. But the motivation to care, the motivation to act, the rationale for how to live, that comes from someplace else. As the authors of the study on solutions for a cultivated planet themselves say, our analysis focuses on the agronomic and environmental aspects of these challenges and leaves a richer discussion of the associated social, economic, and cultural issues to future work. The researchers themselves are convinced that the requirements of current and future generations demand that we transform agriculture to meet the twin challenges of food security and environmental sustainability, but they realize that it's beyond the scope of their study to explain why. Here in the church, we're able to say why. Here in the church, we know that it's a problem if 1/7 of us are hungry, because that sad fact does not reflect the reality of how God hopes for us to live. God's vision is this. I'll read it first from the prophet Ezekiel, chapter 34. I will make my hill a blessing. I will send down the showers in their season. They shall be showers of blessing. The trees of the field shall yield their fruit. The earth shall yield its increase. My people shall be secure on their soil. They shall know that I am the Lord when I break the bars of their yoke and save them from the hands of those who enslave them. They shall no more be plunder for the nations, nor shall the animals of the land devour them. They shall live in safety, and no one shall make them afraid. I will provide for them a splendid vegetation, so that they shall no more be consumed with hunger in the land, and no longer suffer the insults of nations. This vision is spelled out also in Leviticus. This is chapter 26. Again, the voice of God coming through as the writer has written, I will give you your rains in their season, and the land shall yield its produce, and the trees of the field shall yield their fruit. Your threshing shall continue until the vintage, and the vintage shall continue until the sowing, and you shall eat your bread to the full and live securely in your land. And I will grant peace in the land, and you shall lie down, and no one shall make you afraid. I will remove dangerous animals from your midst, and no sword shall go through your land. And then the vision is articulated also by the prophets. And here's an example from Isaiah chapter 65. No more shall there be in the land an infant that lives but a few days, or an old person who doesn't live out a lifetime. For one who dies at 100 will be considered a youth. One who falls short of 100 will be considered accursed. They shall build houses and inhabit them. They shall plant vineyards and eat their fruit. God's intent is that the earth yield food to sustain God's people, and that everyone have access to shelter, to security, to safety. God's vision is that war would cease its devastation of the land and the people. And the name for this harmonious well-being is Shalom. And God urges us to be God's partner in making the sufficiency and the all-inclusive nature of Shalom a reality. We're not only to be building houses and planting vineyards, sowing, harvesting, and threshing grain, tending fruits, and living as free people. When we celebrate our festivals of Thanksgiving, King David is to be our model. King David, who made sure that every man, woman, and child received a portion of the food every time a feast was celebrated. When we gather in the produce of our fields, we're to make sure that we leave some of the grain and some of the grapes behind, so that the poor and those who are far from home may come and gather food there as well. We're to do good, says Psalm 34. We are to do good, seek shalom, and pursue it. The vision of shalom permeates the Bible. I read you a few examples, but they're everywhere. And over time, we see that what's happening is that our understanding of the boundaries of God's shalom keeps being expanded to include more and more people until finally we realize it's meant to encompass all people and all creation. When Jesus came into the world, he came as a living embodiment of God's shalom with the intent to make possible the complete fulfillment of that wonderful vision. And we remember, as Luke tells us, that he described his mission this way. The Spirit of the Lord is upon me because he has anointed me to bring good news to the poor. He sent me to proclaim release to the captives and recovery of sight to the blind, to let the oppressed go free and to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor. We know from the stories in the Gospels that when Jesus was present at mealtime, everybody ate. Everybody got enough. If there was anything that kept people apart, anything that meant that some were included and others were excluded, all of that was abolished in Jesus. He is our peace, who has made us both one and has broken down the dividing wall of hostility, affirms the letter to the Ephesians. Consistent with the faith traditions of the past, Jesus invited and encouraged all of us to personally take part in bringing about God's shalom. I was hungry, and you gave me something to eat. I was thirsty, and you gave me something to drink. I was a stranger, and you welcomed me. I was naked, and you gave me clothing. I was sick, and you took care of me. I was in prison, and you visited me. Come now and inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. Jesus imagines saying to those who catch the vision and live their lives accordingly. In other words, our religion gives very strong guidance on how we are to live. Anyone interested in discovering meaning and purpose would do well to look to time-tested religious tradition for insight and well-articulated vision. As William Brown puts it, we cannot live by science alone. Science excels at describing, even revealing, the wonders of creation. Science can successfully predict how matter will behave, and it can go a long way in helping us understand what results will flow from what action. Science can elucidate choices and consequences. It can help us in many ways, but religion is what shapes how we respond. Religion or faith is what cultivates praise, humility, gratitude, and a sense of co-responsibility for the health and the well-being of the world. Faith is what decides that life has value and that all creation is sacred. Faith brings with it the power to motivate, inspire, and transform. When Jane Goodall says that her greatest hope is that people might again open their eyes to the incredible beauty and value of the world around us, she is getting her hope not just from her observation and her understanding about the resilience of nature, not just from her awareness that the human brain has amazing problem-solving capabilities, but also from her lifelong awareness that there is some spark of the divine in all creatures, and that spiritual power beyond our limited comprehension is all around us, available to us for our good, if we choose to enhance our connection with it. Religion, faith, spirituality, take your pick for the word you prefer, guide us in establishing and affirming the meaning and the purpose of our lives. Science, as no less a person than Albert Einstein pointed out, science can do a great deal to help us identify what means will contribute to the attainment of our goals. In the example that we have been considering involving agricultural practices and world food supply, the faith born of our religion teaches us that if people are hungry, we not only care, we do something about it. What can we do that will actually make a difference? The tools and the information provided by science, if we make use of them, can greatly enhance the effectiveness of our action. And thus, as people of faith and people of science, it is possible for us to move to embrace God's shalom, even as we have been embraced by it. Our prayers this morning, and as we go about our lives, our prayers ask God to help us recognize, reach for, celebrate, and participate in God's vision for our world. Holy God, you pour out your grace upon us and bathe us in visions of your good purposes and your truth. May we be faithful, O God, to the love that wells up within us, a response to your wondrous creation and your restorative, life-giving power. Bless all of us, we ask, with the courage to see and to seek your kingdom. It is our joy to be together here and pray together as Jesus taught us. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. Lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, and the power, and the glory forever. Amen.